hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this episode, we talk to Eleanor Whedon, who has combined sculpture, performance, and walking to explore two North American obsessions, the motor car and the Western frontier. The interview took place at the end of a walking and art residency at Banff in the Rockies and opens with Eleanor describing her art practice.
I guess these days I always sort of consider myself a sculptor making objects, but I've begun to incorporate performative element, which then gets either videotaped or photographed or something, which basically talks about the voyage. And in the end, that's why I'm at this walking and art residency, is because of the incorporation of walking into my own art practice. And I have to actually say that I never really considered my art to be about walking or theorized it as such, as about walking. I had sort of thought about it more in terms of travel, movement, a form of transportation, the voyage, and contextualizing this within a sort of urban planning context, so how people move from A to B, basically. And I guess I might as well at this point clarify some of what I do, so that some of this makes sense. I guess the major piece that I did before coming to the Banff residency, which probably, you know, got me in or had the most walking, was I got a 1995 Ford Taurus from the scrapyard, and I cut the whole thing apart, basically using just sort of the outer shell, so the roof, the bumpers, all the doors, the hoods, the doors, etc. And I formed it, I sort of reshaped it into what I would call the elements of a canoe trip. So there were two canoes, there was a dog sled, there were all these knapsacks, paddles, rucksacks. There were nine pieces, and I got 10 of my very good friends to help me carry this car. And what we did was we portaged around Niagara Falls, and we were following the original 8-mile portage path of explorer Father Louis Hennepin and Robert René de La Salle, who were the first explorers or the first white men to come around Niagara Falls. And essentially what this did in Canadian history and North American history was it opened up the Western frontier. It linked basically the St. Lawrence and therefore the old country to the new country and the sort of idea of the Western frontier. So that was sort of one of the beginnings of this idea of walking. And what I had started to do with this piece and a couple prior was to invert the relationship, literally and I guess figuratively, of human and automobile. So I started carrying cars. And that became, with respect to walking, a way of using like the physical power of the human body as a way to subvert or question our car culture, which in North America, I mean, it's interesting being here and talking to people from, you know, Europe and Australia and stuff, where the cars there are a lot smaller and they seem to be, you know, not the same presence that we have here, where everyone has this huge SUV or truck that they drive in. But yeah, so that I guess is sort of in a nutshell, or a small nutshell, large nutshell, sums up my practice with walking.
Can you explain a bit more about what you're actually doing currently? What's the current project and how walking is incorporated in that?
As an extension from the sort of these car carrying adventures, what I proposed for the Walking and Art Residency was to make a pair of what I'm titling a steel belted snowshoes. So what I've been doing for quite a while now, and also actually I drove my car. I love my car. I drove my car from Toronto to Banff, which is about a 5-day drive. And along the voyage, I picked up all these shredded tires that you see when you're driving down the road. And you might not notice them or think about it, but if you start to look, you see all these shredded tires that have come off Mack trucks all along the side of the road. So I would stop my car, gather them, throw them in the car, and keep going. So what I've been doing is pulling out the steel belting and sort of using the shredded parts. I have welded up steel frames for them so they're not too floppy, but then making these giant, and they're almost as tall as I am. I'm 5'2", and they're pretty darn close. They're about 20 pounds each. They're these giant snowshoes, which I have brought to the epic Rocky Mountain range to sort of play as this mountain man character, which again is a part of the Western frontier and this very epic individualistic mind frame that I'm linking both to the early fur trade and the sort of colonization of the West and the sort of imperialistic opening up of the Western frontier, and linking that essentially to Henry Ford's vision of what the car would do for us, and that very individualistic relationship that we as North Americans have with cars. You know, we love them. We think we're a cowboy when we're driving them. What I've been doing here is making these snowshoes, and then I've been going out and gathering both photographic and video documentation of me sort of flailing around on mountain peaks. And in the same way, what happens when you walk with these items, and it's really especially the snowshoes, are quite insane to walk with, is they're an albatross. They don't help you to stay up on the snow, they hinder you. And it is this way of talking about what car culture is doing to us, you know, global warming, you know, all traffic problems, car accidents, all these things. And, you know, we're so attached to us and we think that we can't live without it. But when you, on the flip side, it's also this albatross. And when you really look at it, it's quite ridiculous. And so, you know, when you're walking on steel belted snowshoes, the way that you walk is ridiculous. You're falling over. And you can see that it's this albatross. I guess in addition to the snowshoes, the other sort of sculptural object that I've made here, which I think I'm actually quite excited about, when I was going through a lot of my initial research, I was looking at old sort of woodcuts and looking at old paintings like the Hudson River School of Painting, and the Hudson Bay Company also commissioned these painters to go out and paint the epicness of the voyagers. And a lot of the white men that were standing at the top of the mountains had these staffs, or would be sort of standing proclaiming, you know, their brilliance at the top of the peak with this staff. So I thought, oh, okay, I should get myself a big stick that I can sort of profess the word with. And then what I've done is I've taken the stick and I've just bolted a rearview mirror onto it. So instantly it's this thing where you recognize that shape or this front, back, side so instantly. And then it's attached to this stick and it becomes ridiculous. But the other thing that the rearview mirror does for me, and I've used it a lot in my work in terms of some of the pieces, like the canoe pieces, they're all three mirrors involved in that piece. But when I was doing the videoing, I was using shots of the rearview. And to me, it's a way of looking forward and backwards at the same time. So you're addressing thoughts of the future, maybe a certain hopefulness as you drive west into the frontier, but you're also escaping something, or there's some historical past, there's something that is also registering and it's there at the same time. So it's, and in my work as well, it's this layering of history and future. It's because in the end, I think my work, at least what I hope my work is that it's this quest for change, or it's this utopian, and it's using humor, and of course it's ridiculous. We're not going to walk on steel belted snowshoes, but it's this quest to find a different way to exist. And so anyways, yeah, basically I've made these snowshoes, and I was with the snowshoes because I was so unstable and kept falling over, I also used the pole. And so the video actually that I'm working on editing now has clips of me on the snowshoes with the stick, and just the stick, and it's this, I become this sort of comical, but I also try to be somewhat stoic to the best of my ability in the ridiculous surroundings. And so it's kind of mocking or poking fun at the colonial past that we have and our present situation with the car.
Are you following a particular route, or are you trying to look at particular routes that were taken by these voyagers or discoverers?
Well, the first piece that I did was I actually just made a little knapsack, and I started walking around the clover leaves around Buffalo, New York, because that's where I was living at the time. And looking at that footage, it was really kind of post-apocalyptic in the way it looked. And then when I was talking with other people, we thought, well, what if we relocate you back to a site of wilderness, quote-unquote, because Niagara Falls is definitely, quote-unquote, wilderness. But choosing that very specific historic trade route, that 8-mile portage, had a very specific historical significance. When I was researching coming out to the Rocky Mountains, I knew that the Rocky Mountains would work for this work, A, because the landscape is so majestic. It's so sublime. It really has that. I think it is almost the epitome of what North Americans would consider this epic Western frontier. So basically, you get up on any mountain peak and there's that reference to. Secondly, there was actually a Rocky Mountain Fur Company, and it was located south of what is now our border, but it did come up into Canada, and we're very close. We're maybe 40 kilometers from the Continental Divide, so there was definitely trade over there. And when I was researching this area, I had thought initially, like, yeah, it'd be awesome. I'm going to find a route, I'm going to find a historic pass, and I'm going to hike it on my snowshoes. And this pass, which also was a peak, House Pass and Peak, came up as one of the places where the first white man to cross the Great Divide. And as I began to research this, I realized that actually it's a very difficult hike. It's about 3 days to get to the top, and it's beginning parts of it. You're just in wooded area, and it's not very epic. And I began to think, you know what, if I'm going to do this, this is a whole other thing in terms of the planning. Like, I've done a lot of outdoor camping and hiking and canoeing and stuff, but with this work, it's become more just the idea of, less than a very specific route, but hoping that just this area in general has enough sort of historical presence. But I guess that can lead into, that question can lead into something else that I hope to do with my art practice. What I began to realize doing these different projects where, you know, either I was out struggling in the bush or a bunch of my friends were out struggling in the bush and I was videotaping them, was that, you know, you can look at the objects, you can look at the footage, and you can get this really romantic, beautiful idea of what's happening. But if you're physically the one that is out there doing the voyage or the walk or, you know, whatever, there's something very special that happens in that actual the group dynamics or the group of what happens there, because it is a struggle and you have to overcome certain things, but that can be very, very empowering. So one of the things that I'd like to do with this work, and I guess other projects, you know, possibly the canoe as well, and, you know, the walking sticks or the snowshoes at some point, is to work with different community groups, you know, whether it's a group of kids, you know, through a youth center, or whether it's, you know, a women's shelter, or it doesn't have to be, you know, a special needs, quote unquote, population, but work with someone other than just my friends or other artists and make the work more about the actual physical event than about recording for a gallery setting. And so in that case, you know, I might be more interested in the historic spot because that might become a project or quite a long research project where I begin to work with a community and we begin to research the actual historic roots in their particular location. You know, what are their land claims? What bands of Native people moved through there? Which explorers moved through? How did they move through that land? So it becomes, I guess, educational in the sense of looking at the history of colonization and then also looking at maybe your own, for example, in St. Catharines, Ontario. I can't remember what the name of the main street is, but it's shaped in this giant boomerang, and it is the residual of an old trading route. And so that would be a really interesting place to stage a performance because it's this old trail that has literally become a road, the main street. And so, you know, if you were to snowshoe down that with a group of people, there would be a lot to be said about the history of the past and the traffic of the present day. So yeah, that's another sort of extension of what I've realized with this work, is that there's something about the physical act of walking that is very empowering. And so that's something that I want to begin to try and expand on.
So do you see yourself in part an activist in that you want to bring to people's attention wrongs in the past?
I'm an artist who considers that everything is political. It can't be apolitical and that things have a message. I think there's quite a literal and evident message in what I'm doing. I hope that it doesn't become too preachy or didactic with its use of humor. But I mean, I came to art fairly late, you know, in my own life so far. But what I had done before, I did a degree in environmental studies and Canadian studies, so it's a very obvious progression from there. But really looking at urban planning and use of natural materials and resources, and really thinking like cradle to grave about things. So when I'm out there resurrecting a car from the scrapyard or picking up shredded tires, I'm really thinking about the fact that these materials got extracted from the earth, they were used, they may or may not have polluted during their lifetime, but they're still sitting around, and what are we going to do with them?
Have you any recommendations to our listeners as to where they might enjoy walking? You did say you were in love with your car, which is slightly
risque.
You know, risque. Perhaps, do you drive to go for a walk, or do you actually walk from your doorstep occasionally?
I think it depends on where I am living at the time, and I've lived in a town in the Yukon with 2000, and I've lived in Toronto. And I find when I'm in an urban city that I walk, I also bike a lot, but I walk as a mode of transportation. So it's like I'm out the door and I'm just head down walking, getting from point A to point B. I'm not very observant when I walk in an urban setting. I'm really just going, but I find that walking can actually be quite meditative. You just get into the rhythm and you may go for an hour or whatever, but it's quite meditative. When I'm walking in a more wilderness situation or the bush, like Banff is, and I mean, we can literally walk out the back door and go up a mountain, I would say that there's more of this observation, pleasure, exploratory nature to it, although I do tend to walk quite fast and get into a meditative thing. In Banff, anywhere. It's astounding. You can go for a day walk in so many places. I really like Stanley Glacier. I've gone there a few times now. Also, Johnson Lake is really gorgeous. I mean, there's so many places. But I've done some hiking in Tombstone National Park, I think it's what it's called, in the Yukon at the Dempster Highway, and it's absolutely stunning.
What changes do you think would need to happen to encourage more people to walk more?
Herein lies the question. I did some research when I was doing my initial degree about what instigates change. You know it's bad to drive a car, and yet you do it. I'm talking to myself right now. I really think that there's probably a lot of things. They talk about the tipping point, like when things come to a point at which they change. And I think that often there's a lot of things that converge to make that happen. I really hate to say it, but I think economics is a big one. I think when gas is what it costs in Europe, which is 2.5 times, people will stop driving as much. They'll stop buying bigger cars. And I think, I hate to say it, but I really think that's the primary one. Part of why I hate to say it is because it punishes those who have less money faster and harder. I think the other thing, though, is when there does come to be more momentum and stuff where it becomes socially inappropriate to drive a block to buy a quart of milk and you sort of feel some sort of pressure. I mean, it's like certain places it's almost acceptable to drink and drive, and other places just that social pressure. You just wouldn't do it. Even if you could and wouldn't get in an accident, you wouldn't do it. And then I also do think, in addition to economics, just like legislation, like our government needs to get serious. I don't know, what do you think? I don't know, I mean, you've also
come across
some of these things.
I'd just say that it can't be just one thing. I mean, it's the price of petrol in Europe is very high compared to Canada, but it doesn't stop people driving.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of things that will cause a change, perhaps.
And then I guess also making things possible. Like, I know you and Rebecca were talking about whether footpaths were open, whether you could use them. So, you know, is it safe for a pedestrian to walk? Are there crosswalks? Yeah. Is there, you know, a pedestrian lane?
I was sort of hinting at it because of you and I went on the walk in Calgary, on the outskirts of Calgary, and whether there was anything there you thought could change to encourage more people to walk. And for me, one of the things that was desperate about the whole experience was it was just so dull. There was so little of interest for the walker to absorb or observe. And you were saying yourself that when you're in a town, tend to put your head down and go from A to B and not actually observe things.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not so important, but to me, that sort of diversity of visual things
stimulation
is really important, but maybe...
Yeah, that was quite a horrendous walk that we went on. Walking through urban sprawl. Absolutely. But it was not safe. It was not easy because like you mentioned, it was 2.5 kilometers before we could find a mailbox. Like, you know, everything is totally set out at the scale of a car. I mean, if you lived in one of those multi-million-dollar houses, you can't do anything without a car.
Yeah.
You can't even go to your neighbor's house without a car. Like, it's so
spread out. Describing it.
You and I can get up and walk, but not everyone in the population can get up and walk, or seniors and stuff like that. So it also then, I think, becomes maybe making a combination of things, like public transit, where it's okay to bring a giant bundle buggy or, you know, groceries on, and you're not going to be inconveniencing people, or a mom who has like a giant stroller may not want to walk 10K but can sort of do some walking in a market and then get on a bus, or, you know, things like that, where it just becomes easier to get around with a car, basically.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities. In this episode, you've heard from Eleanor Whedon, the creator of steel-belted snowshoes, fashioned from shredded tires gleaned from the sides of highways. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Please follow the links on the talkingwalking.net website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes at talkingwalking.net.